Welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and with me on the line from Weber County is USU's Extension Horticulturist, Jerry Goodspeed. And we hope you'll call with your questions or comments to 1-800-826-1495. You can also email us your question at upraccess@gmail.com or tweet us a question at hashtag AUGarden. Jerry, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, this summer has been completely pretty much different than the last two summers.
Isn't that incredible how much that changes?
Yeah, in Utah, it's just usually never the same. I'm going to start out asking one question, though. I have seen, and I was hoping that the populations would be down, but okay, well, those are absolutely some technical difficulties that we'll get taken care of. But, okay, this is live. This is Brian Earle. I'm your host for the program. And Mark Anderson is in studio with us today. And we're going to talk anything garden. If you'd like to call in with your question or comment, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also tweet us your question at hashtag AUGarden, and then you can also send us your email question, upraccess@gmail.com. Mark, thanks for coming in.
You're very welcome. Glad to be here.
And if we could get our, can we get Mark's mic turned on? That would be really great. Thank you very much. All right. So actually, Mark, we're going to have our first question. Actually is from last week, and it's our first tweet. Someone wanted to know where is a good place to plant a Japanese maple around a home.
You know, the Japanese maple, like a shadier location for the most part, and it depends on which variety of maple you go with, but most of them like a shadier location. So generally east side or the north side of the house works really well. If you have a lot of shade, you know, on your west or your south side, of course, you could put it on that part of your house as well. We've got one in front of our house, but our house kind of faces south, and it kind of sticks out to the west a little bit. So we've got on the south side, but where part of the house blocks it from the west sun in the afternoon. So it gets sun in the morning, but then it's got shade from about 1 o'clock on, and it works just great. And it's a very fine lace leaf red Japanese maple, and we haven't had any problems with it at all. So it's a little more protected right there next to the house. So it stays a little warmer during the winter time, but then it's protected from that late afternoon sun.
So what are some of the things to look for with Japanese that maybe they don't quite like about our climate? Just so you have to keep it a little bit protected.
Yeah. Most of the Japanese maple are in the zone 5, zone 6. And so you've got to watch out that we don't get any zone 6, especially in Cache Valley.
Well, if you believe the USDA map, we're now zone 6, which is absolutely ludicrous.
But that's not correct. I don't care how much global warming we've had. It's not going to make it in Cache Valley. There's a lot of really nice varieties of maples out there. They are definitely susceptible to sunburn, so they need that shade. And then it just depends on where you live and what your lowest temperatures are in the wintertime, because like the west side of Cache Valley tends to be much, much colder in the wintertime than the east side of Cache Valley. So if you're
the
in Mendon,
settled.
Yeah, so if you're in Mendon or Amalga or Clarkston, Wellsville, it's always much colder than it is on, like, say, the benches of Logan or Providence or North Logan, or, you know, even Richmond is warmer. And so that's something to take into consideration as well.
Okay, and are they usually, as far as the soil pH, they're okay with our
not a problem.
Even now though and they're then, Japanese,
yeah, maybe. Even every now and then a little bit of iron deficiency or iron chlorosis will show up, so kind of watch for that and supplement them with a little bit of iron, maybe once in the spring, or if you want to go with a slow release iron like a ferrous sulfate or iron sulfate, do that very late in the fall, so it'll break down through the winter. And that iron will be available to the plant first thing in the spring.
So by putting that on, and this kind of launches into another question, so that type of iron, even though it's not readily available to the plant immediately, it turned into what you would call a chelated iron so that the plant can use
it? Yeah, well, the chelation process basically pre-digests the iron and breaks it down into a form that the plants can pick it up and utilize it much
quicker. So it's like it was
quicker.
Chelated.
Yeah, so if you put it on in the fall, it'll break down over the winter time and decompose, and then all of a sudden the iron will be more accessible to the plant first thing in the spring. Where when you apply a slow-release product like the iron sulfate, it takes a while for the plants to be able to digest it and to utilize it. Sometimes it's 6 weeks to 3 months before the plants can even pick it up. But if you use it late in the fall, Mother Nature will kind of break it down over the wintertime, especially if you have a good microbe buildup or a content in your soil. If you're using a lot of compost or humate, you know, the soil activator or compost tea works really well. Have you ever tried any of the compost tea we've been brewing?
I have not. I've definitely got compost.
You got to come in and get it, because the compost tea is not just like taking your compost and running water through it and then trying to collect the microorganisms. This is like you're infusing air into the tea, and it's making the aerobic microbes multiply like crazy, and so it's like supercharging your compost and your microbes and your microorganism activity in your soil, and just making them go like crazy. They just decompose all kinds of material, whether it's organic matter, or they break down, you know, pesticides and diseases, and they break down nutrient, make it available to your plants. So they just kind of go out there and eat everything up and break it down and digest it for the plants. It's really amazing stuff.
Yeah. We're going to go to our first caller.
Yeah.
We have Jerry in Grace, Idaho. Hi, Jerry. How can we help?
Hi. I have a question about my raspberries. They did not do very well at all this year. I'm wondering what I ought to do about them. Should I dig them up and start over? They're short. They didn't grow very tall. The leaves are a little tiny and kind of curled.
Kind of small.
I don't know what to do.
Do you know what variety they are?
No, I don't.
Are they raspberries that produce a bunch all at once in the middle of the summer and then they're done, or do they produce again in the fall?
No, they're one time.
Okay,
only.
So they're once and done. Real thorny, or they
yeah.
have thorns, and they're not real scratchy.
No, they're prickly.
Okay, so they're really prickly. I was thinking you might have canby, but canbies are almost thornless, and so
no,
they
I don't have those.
Okay, so they're a June bearing crop, but they're really thorny.
Yeah.
All right. A lot of the June bearing raspberries will not produce a lot if they're not pruned properly, of course, in the spring. So usually what you want to do is with Primocane raspberries like that, you want to actually do your pruning first thing in the spring instead of mm-hmm. in the fall. And you don't want to prune them down really low to the ground. You actually want to just take about the top third off of the growth that came up from the previous year.
Okay.
And so when they're like 3-4 feet tall, sometimes even taller, in the springtime, as soon as the snow melts, we'll go out there and we'll just take the top third off the top. And it makes them bush out. And where they bush out, they'll produce more fruit. Then when they're done producing, we will take our pruners and cut them out right down to the ground. So all those canes that produced this year, you want to prune those out right down to the ground and then let the new growth come up. And that's what's going to produce for you next year. And to really get them to grow tall and to produce a lot for you, you need to hit them with a fairly high nitrogen fertilizer at least once or twice during the growing season. I like to do it first thing in the spring and then usually again right after I'm done picking to encourage some growth out of those new canes that are all coming up. And definitely watch for iron chlorosis. So if the leaves are turning yellow and you're getting dark green veins running through the leaves, that can stunt their growth as well, too. So probably sounds like you need to do a little bit more fertilizing and definitely a little bit more pruning.
Okay. Is there anything I can do this late in the season to encourage them to feel happy and joyful in the spring?
Yeah. You know, right now is the perfect time to put like ammonium sulfate, which is a quick-release nitrogen, but it has sulfur in there as well, too. And the raspberries really like the ammonium sulfate. Highly recommended by Utah State Extension for raspberries, and it will encourage a lot of new growth. So you'll get 3 or 4 feet of growth out of those canes that have come up this year, and then prune those first thing in the spring, fertilize them again, and then they'll produce for you like crazy next year.
Awesome.
All right.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Good luck with your raspberries next year.
Thanks for your call.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. You know, I remember one year, because I don't usually put anything extra other than iron on my raspberries.
Yeah.
But I remember one year I thought, I'll try a slow-release nitrogen like I put on the grass.
Yeah.
Oh, my heavens. I had the biggest canes I've ever had.
Yeah. And so that you need to really encourage – when you think about, you know, fruit production and flowering, you think you usually want to use more phosphorus because that's what encourages root development and flower production and fruit production. But on the raspberries, they really need that long growth to produce properly.
Initially.
Yeah. And so you've got to hit them with a nitrogen at least once or twice during the season to get that tall, you know, 3, 4, 5 foot of growth out of them, because – that's where your production is going to be the next year, is off of that growth from this year. If you're doing, you know, June bearing raspberries, if you're doing ever bearing raspberries, it's a little bit different. So we'd prune them slightly differently from what I just recommended.
So was I okay using a slow release nitrogen on my ever bearers?
Absolutely. Yeah. Great way to go. So we like to use and recommend the ammonium sulfate because of the high sulfur content, because that lowers the pH and it frees up the iron and makes it available to the raspberries. So that's why we usually recommend the ammonium sulfate, because it has about 25% sulfur in it, which our soils are very alkaline. The pH is really high. And so anytime we can bring the pH down, it frees up and makes iron more available to the plants, which is consistently a problem with raspberries.
Well, let me ask you then, with going back to our discussion about iron, if I were to use the iron sulfate on a regular basis, would I get to a point then I wouldn't need to use chelated iron, because the stuff is through the roof expensive?
Yeah, the chelated iron is expensive, but it works really fast. If you're doing like the iron sulfate in the fall and then again first thing in the spring. With time and you know, with the right, you know, microorganisms in your soil, you know, if you're using a little bit of soil activator or doing the compost tea or something like that, it would release all that iron and make it available to your plants.
So I'm probably going to want to do a combination of the two for maybe a year
for a while,
or two.
Yeah.
And then once I've got the other going.
And extra sulfur always helps too, because you just got to maintain that pH and keep that down in the 6.5, you know, 7 range, or else in many cases if it gets higher than that, then the iron sulfate just gets bound up in the soil and your plants can never get to it, never use it.
Well, one thing I have noticed this year, I didn't seem to have much in the way of the horntail wasp.
Oh,
I had
yeah.
a few here and there. You know, I do my mechanical method of going out and feeling where they are and squishing the little buggers in the canes, and then the canes stand back up again and keep growing.
Yep, we've seen a lot of raspberry cane borer this year.
Yeah,
actually,
a ton.
And so I've had a lot of people bringing samples in. So once the tops of your canes really, you know, die down, basically the only thing you can do is prune out the top 18 inches of the cane and destroy it. You know, get rid of it.
Well, it's so disheartening. I've got a variety called Royalty.
Yeah.
That's pretty prickly, but it is it's a June bearing type. And they were coming on early and looking really good. I'll bet I've got at least 90% dead canes.
Yeah.
They just died. I don't know if it was the cane borer or the rose stem girdler. I'm thinking it's the cane borer, but I'm just going to take them out. And
there's crown borer also, which is different from your cane borer, which will attack the root system and the crowns right where they come up out of the soil, instead of the cane borer, which attacks it usually 16 inches, 2 feet off the ground and just will damage the new
growth. So is that related
to
the rose stem girdler?
No. Entirely different critter. But very difficult to control. And once they get into your canes, they can wipe the whole patch out almost in a single season. And so that's something you definitely would want to watch out for. A soil drench of a broad spectrum insecticide just on the ground, just to water the plants with. That's what usually takes care of those.
Is that
best.
Something you do in the early fall?
Actually, you'd want to do
those?
It first thing in the spring.
Okay.
Yeah, first thing in the spring. Generally, I'd say around the first part of April, and again, maybe the first part of May if you've had problems with it in the past. We haven't seen a lot of it the last few years, but insect populations are just astronomically large this year. I mean, they just exploded this year. And so we've had a lot of different insect issues that we've had to deal with that we haven't had the last couple of years.
I mean, I haven't seen much in the way, at least in the same populations that I've had in the past, of earwigs. But I was in hopes that the grasshopper problem wouldn't be as much, but it's
and the grasshoppers
just as bad
are just horrendous this year. Yeah, probably even worse than last year.
And there's probably at this point there's not a whole lot you can do because they're all the Nolo bait doesn't work. It's a little too big.
The Nolo bait works really well earlier on, so usually by the middle part of June is when you want to start applying your Nolo bait, and you don't want to get it on too early because it works best when the grasshoppers. Food source, you know, where they're coming from is starting to turn brown and drying up. And last year that didn't happen until like the middle of July. So it didn't have great control on the grasshoppers with the Nolo bait last year because their season was just so wet that the bait didn't work very well. But this year dried up much quicker. And so around the first part of June, the grasshoppers were starting to migrate from their feeding areas into people's yards. You know, so they were coming from the field out back or the vacant lot next door and moving to greener pastures. And that's when the Nolo bait actually works the best. But we've been using a new product this year. It's called Bug Blaster. It's from High Yield. The Bug Blaster, I sprayed my garden very early on when I started to see a lot of little grasshoppers before I was really harvesting anything. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see a grasshopper for at least 4 weeks. I mean, it just really knocked them down. And it's been working very, very effectively on even the larger grasshoppers. So really good stuff. A newer generation synthetic pyrethroid. So similar to permethrin, but it's a newer generation. So
how do you spray it?
I just used a tank sprayer. I just mixed it up in a tank sprayer and went out and just hit the – they were just massacring my potatoes. They were just eating my potatoes up like crazy. So I sprayed my potatoes, hit the onions, hit the carrot tops, you know, all the stuff that I wasn't harvesting. Yeah. And then I did probably 10 or 15 feet all the way out around the garden. So as they were coming into the garden, it would get them before they got in the garden. And just very, very happy with the results. Worked really well.
It's so funny in my garden. They don't tend to eat any of my vegetables, but they go after the raspberries.
Yeah.
They just
interesting.
Are terrible on the raspberries and my comfrey plants. I've got two of those, and they're just shredded. Absolutely shredded. And then there are some ornamentals. They love clematis. They love to eat, and this is in the middle of my grass.
Yeah.
They love clematis. They love honeysuckle. I've got a new vine that's just there aren't any leaves left on
sure.
it. They've just chewed it right
grasshoppers
down.
Grasshoppers have been just horrendous this year. And it's not just the grasshoppers. I've had explosions of box elder bugs. So the box elder bugs have been crazy.
Yeah.
Aggressive house spiders have been just in huge numbers this year. We've just seen tons of those. Lots of customers bringing in their little traps, and they've got them like stuck all over their traps and just tons of those.
I think the mild winter must have had something to do with it because it only dropped below zero, I think,
once. It was a wetter season last year, and so we're seeing just huge amounts of weeds because the weed seed production was off the charts last year because of all the moisture. And then this year with the hotter, drier weather, the weeds, wherever you're watering, they are just coming up like crazy. I've never seen so many weeds in my garden before this year. I mean, it's just almost more than we can stay on top of. So.
And that's why you have, I'm hesitant to call it slave labor, but children.
they're not too bad.
Learning work skills by pulling those weeds.
Yeah, I actually don't mind pulling weeds, but we took off for about 10 days. We had some business going on. We tried to have a little fun, you know, at the same time.
And then you come back.
And you come back and it's like, oh my gosh, you know, the weeds just, it's like we hadn't weeded before we left, even though we had, so.
You're listening to Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden. This is Access Utah. To join our conversation, our toll-free number is good anywhere you listen to us in the 48 continental United States anyway, 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Tweet us your question, hashtag AUGarden, or email us your question at upraccess@gmail.com. So I wanted to also talk about some issues as far as helping your garden along to make sure that your fruits are ripening correctly or getting as big as they can.
Sure.
What vegetables tend to like to have a little bit of a boost in feeding? Like usually it's nitrogen corn, voracious feeders of that. I usually put some on when it's about knee high, and then again when it starts – tasseling out.
Yeah. Yeah. Usually we'll recommend at about 12 inches, at about 3 feet tall. And then again, when it tassels, I just did my corn this weekend. So we planted a later crop. We planted our corn a little bit later because we're trying to like do different things with different gardens. And so we planted our corn a little bit later and we just fertilized it because it's about 3 feet tall and, it won't be long and it'll be producing like crazy. So we're excited about that, but definitely a higher nitrogen for the corn. Right now is actually a really good time to do kind of a balanced fertilizer for a lot of your vegetables. So nitrogen, of course, is going to stimulate top growth. It's going to green things up, make them grow. And so corn's a heavy nitrogen feeder. Most of your other vegetables, except for your leafy greens and things, like a higher phosphorus, which is a higher middle number. And that's what is going to encourage root development, flower production, and fruit production. And so we'll usually use a fertilizer with a higher middle number than with a higher first number for almost all your vegetables. Like I said, the corn's the exception because corn really likes the nitrogen. So we just use straight nitrogen for the corn. So
what about
potatoes? I used ammonium sulfate for the corn. Potatoes, again, more of a root crop, and so a higher phosphorus is great for those. Generally, we'll do a tablespoon of bone meal, which is a great natural, source of phosphorus for
plants.
Just
when you plant them?
Yeah, when we plant. And I dug one hill of potatoes up the other day just to see what's going on because, again, we got our potatoes planted a little bit later also. It was almost the 1st of June by the time we got our potatoes in. And I got 2 pounds of potatoes off of that one hill. So one little quarter of a potato piece produced about 8 to 10 potatoes that equaled about 2 pounds of potatoes off of just one hill. And I put bone meal in with mine.
What do you do to ensure success that those pieces are actually going to produce something? And it seemed like it was the variety. For this year, it was the Yukon Gold.
Didn't do much for you.
I got maybe 50%, and that hasn't happened before. Yeah. So I'm always wondering what can I do to encourage them to...
Potatoes, usually when you're planting, you want to have, fairly dry conditions so that you can, get them planted and get them to grow. But they do need a good source of moisture. I know a lot of people struggled last year because the soil was so cold and so wet that the potatoes just didn't come up. They just like rotted in the ground. So it's almost a fine line of how to water them to get those potatoes to come up. Because if the soil's too dry, they don't do very well. And if the soil's way too wet and cold, they don't do very well. So you got to have to find a happy medium in there where there's a good amount of soil moisture, but it's not too soggy and wet and definitely not too dry. And the problem we had this year was when we were planting our potatoes, we had some extra helpers. And extra helpers decided it was a good idea to pull the sprouts off of the potatoes while they were planting. And so part of ours didn't come up very well either, but
thank you, helpers.
But the rest of them came up really, really good. So, and with that extra bone meal out there, they're coming up like crazy.
It's like a tablespoon per hole.
Tablespoon per hole. Put your potato piece right on top of that, cover it up. And then as the root system starts to grow, it grows right into the bone meal, has that high source of phosphorus, very slow release. I mean, it takes all summer. In fact, your bone meal probably continue to release phosphorus all the way through next year as well too. And so it's a very slow release type phosphorus. It's great for all your root crops.
But it's one you can't put on the top.
No,
to put it down the roots.
It's got to be down in where the roots are going to be. So right now, if you want to top dress some of your plants to encourage a little bit extra growth, Natural Guard has a tomato and vegetable food that is brand new this year that's amazing. It's full of mycorrhiza, microbes, microorganisms. It's got calcium and it's got all your major nutrients and a lot of micros in there as well too. Very, very nice all-natural source of fertilizer for your garden. And then Fertilome makes tomato and vegetable food, which is also very, very good. A little bit quicker, a little quicker release. But we've used both of those with amazing results. And you can side dress your plants with them. For tomatoes, you'd use maybe 3-4 tablespoons on the ground around your tomato plants, maybe in a 2x2, 3x3 area, kind of work it into that whole area around the plant and see a nice boost of growth. And then the plant says they're starting to really produce right now and encourages a little bit more fruit and flower production as well too. But good time to fertilize the tomatoes. Also good time to start cutting back on your water on the tomatoes. We don't want them to think that they're invincible and grow for the rest of the fall. We want them.
What
to
if
think
you planted them
croak.
A little bit late? Don't I want them to grow a little bit
bigger?
We want
to grow them a little bit bigger, but usually by the first part of August, we're starting to cut our water back and stress them just a little bit so they know that fall's coming and it's time to reproduce, and that means ripe tomatoes and gets them going. If you're babying them and fertilizing them and watering them, they think that they're invincible and they're going to live forever, and they just don't have to produce ripe fruit to reproduce themselves as quickly. And so by stressing them just a little bit this time of year, I mean, we don't want them laying flat on the ground from lack of water, but let them really kind of wilt during the day before you water them the next time, and they will ripen up a lot quicker.
Well, you're listening to Access Utah. Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden is with us. Right now, we're going to hear the latest edition of Wild About Utah, and then we'll be back for the rest of the half hour. Call with your questions or comments, 1-800-826-1495. Email us at upraccess@gmail.com, or tweet us your question at #AUGarden. Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
This is Linda Curvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society. We credit the Chinese with inventing paper 2,000 years ago, but some social wasps have been making their paper nests for eons. Species of paper wasps are found throughout Utah. The burly, bald-faced hornet workers are patterned in black and white. They place their gray, basketball-sized paper nests in tree branches. Bold yellow and black-striped yellow jackets are the persistent, unwelcome guests at summer picnics. They, too, wrap their round nests in an envelope of paper, but typically place it in a shallow underground chamber. Within the paper envelope, both hornets and yellow jackets have a multi-tiered stack of paper honeycombs, like an inverted pagoda. Our most familiar paper wasps belong to the genus Polistes. These are the reddish-brown, spindly-looking wasps. They make their simple paper nests under your home's roof eaves and deck railings. A Polistes nest consists of a single inverted paper honeycomb suspended from a stiff, short stalk. There is no paper envelope, so you can readily see the hexagonal paper cells. Around your yard, look for the workers scraping fibers from weathered wood surfaces. Workers mix the chewed fibers with saliva and water, carry the ball of wood pulp home, and add it to the thin sheets of their paper nest. The nest is their nursery, where you can see the queen's tiny sausage-shaped eggs and the fat white grubs. The grubs are fed by their sisters, the workers, who scour the surrounding habitat for insect prey or damaged fruit. Utah has been invaded by the European species Polistes dimimula. These interlopers are displacing our native Polistes. Where these European Polistes wasps are a stinging nuisance, you can easily dispatch them at their nests with a sprayed solution of dishwashing detergent and water. Thus stripped of its clever defenders, take the opportunity to admire their homes of paper. This is Linda Curvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by the law firm of Hilliard Anderson & Olson, with offices at the Riverwoods Business Complex in Logan at 600 South Main, in practice for more than 40 years. Information is online at hao-law.com.
Hello and welcome back to the second half hour, well, 20 3 minutes of Access Utah. Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan is my guest. If you'd like to call with your question or comment, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can tweet us your question, hashtag AU Garden, or you can also email us your question at upraccess@gmail.com. So we were talking during that break in the program about what, Mark? I'm trying to remember what we were just talking about.
We were talking about, of course, onions.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So onions is, I planted them from seed in mid-March, and they did really well, and then I just didn't get around to thinning them. And I'm now the poster child for someone who can tell you what happens when you don't thin your onions, because I finally got around to thinning them about a month ago, and now they're starting to get big.
Yeah,
they just seem to know how much room they've got to grow and won't grow if they're crowded.
You know, a great time to start your onions from seed is actually in the next couple of weeks. So if you want to start your onions from seed and be really successful with your onion plants for next year, towards the end of this month, around the 20th of August, is really prime time for starting your own seeds. Do you remember Dr. Pollard, who was a professor here at Utah State? I don't know if you ever met him or not. He would always start his onions on exactly the 18th of August. That was his date. And by the time fall rolls around and things are starting to cool down, the onions are pretty good size. I mean, they're still small green onions, but they're pretty good size. And then winter comes, the onions will just winter over right there in the garden. And then in the spring, as soon as the snow melts, they just pop right back up. They just stand right back up. And then he would dig up, you know, full clumps of them, because he'd plant them in big blocks. He'd plant them in squares, you know, so it's just like onions all the way through. He'd dig the blocks up, and then he would transplant those out he'd dig them up and then transplant them to where he wanted them for the summertime around the middle to the latter part of March, and thin them at that point. And so then he'd have one plant every 3 inches. And then during the growing season, he'd take every other plant for green onions, and then he'd have plenty of room between his plants. And by the end of July, first part of August, his onions would be, you know, softball size or larger, depending on what variety was grown. And that's kind of the way we do ours now too. If we want to start our own seed, you know, we'll do it by the latter part of August. If we want to do plants, like we bring in tons of plants in the springtime, you know, Dolce Grande and Big Daddy and Candy and Walla Walla and all those, we'll transplant those out as early as we possibly can. And right now, my dad's onions, because he got his planted a lot earlier than I did, his are huge, and they're pretty much done. I mean, his tops were all dying down on their own, and so he dug them up last week and is starting to dry them so that they'll store through the wintertime. Where mine, I got planted probably 6 to 8 weeks later than his, and they'll be ready by the end of this month. And so mine are a little bit slower, but they're starting to get some nice size to them also. And we do them the same way, you know, transplant those and those plants out, and they do exceptionally well.
So when you're planting them in the fall, since an onion is a biennial, how do you keep the onion from putting energy into making the seed head rather than in the
Do it late in the summer like this, they just don't grow far enough along to really have a problem with them going to seed the next year. And so they winter over and then just come up amazingly well the next spring. If you grow them during the summertime and then leave them in the ground over winter, and then they come up first thing the next year, then they go straight to seed. But even then, you know, sometimes they'll start to develop seed pods throughout the summertime. We just go through and trim those off. That works really well. But when you do the green onions from seed and then let them winter over and then transplant them next year, you don't have the split centers like you do sometimes with the onion sets. And they do really, really well.
We have our next caller. We have Kathy from Hyde Park. Hi, Kathy. How can we help?
Hello. I planted potatoes last year, and they got like foot and a half tall, beautiful, beautiful, and then turned brown and died. So I thought, okay, this year we'll just let them. I didn't plant any this year. Let them just rest.
Sure.
And then there were a few that we didn't dig up who came up this year. Same thing happened. They grew to like a foot and then turned brown and died. So what can I do to grow potatoes?
Do you know what variety you planted last year?
Detroit Reds.
How about Norland or Pontiac.
Possible Pontiac. Yeah.
Okay. Some varieties are more susceptible to like early and late blight, which can be a problem. And then all of them are susceptible to verticillium and fusarium wilt, mm-hmm. which will cause the plants to just look like they're not getting any water and then just die. So did you see spots on the leaves last year as they were starting to decline, or did they just like look like they weren't getting any water, but they were getting plenty and then they just keeled over dead?
No, it started with spots. You're right.
Okay, so spots then. That's probably either early or late blight then, which actually is fairly easily controlled with a fungicide.
Okay.
Copper soap, basic copper sulfate, all very, very safe to use in the garden.
As they're starting to grow.
As they're starting to grow, you'd spray the plants with the copper soap, yeah, which is really, really super low toxicity for people, but very effective on all kinds of diseases. It works really well on the early and the late blight. So as your plants get probably 6 inches tall and they're coming up, just a light spray every maybe 3 weeks, 4 weeks with the copper soap would probably take care of it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
What we have done before in the past also is when you cut your potatoes to plant them, since there are other soil-borne diseases that can be a problem, we will let them heal overnight before we plant them. And so cut them the day before you're going to plant them. And just let them sit overnight in the garage or wherever.
They kind of seal.
Yeah, they kind of seal up. And then we'll treat them with a little bit of fungicide like Captan or, again, dusting sulfur. And it actually really helps prevent diseases from entering into the potato through the fresh cuts.
Okay.
And so that's another thing that would really be helpful for you for next year.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Kathy.
Bye-bye.
All right. See ya.
Bye-bye. It's 1-800-826-1495. Mark, so let's talk about fall planting. It really should be coming up. And I just tilled in about a week and a half ago all of my peas.
Yeah.
So I've got this nice bed that's got lots of nitrogen in it. And I'm thinking, okay, this is where I'm going to put some more spinach and some lettuce. And maybe I can even get some arugula to grow.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So usually by the first or middle part of July, all the spinach is dying down. The lettuces are starting to go to seed. Peas are all done. You know, and so you can take those areas where those plants are declining or are about ready to kick the bucket and till those all in, you know, maybe add a little bit of organic matter, a little bit of fertilizer, work that all into the soil, and then replant back in those areas. And by the end of July, 1st of August, you can replant all your cold crops again. So cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, spinach, lettuce.
Do you plant from seed?
Yeah.
Broccoli?
Oh, absolutely.
And they'll make it?
Oh, plenty of time. Plenty of time. Usually they will be producing in 75 to 90 days. And if you're doing that right now, they'll be coming on middle of October, some of those varieties, which is cooling down. You know, we can have a little bit of frost, but it definitely won't bother the cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli at all. And you'll have just a great crop of cabbage and cauliflower for late October, you know, sometimes even first part of November. That's when a lot of the growers actually will grow cauliflower for Thanksgiving. They'll do a late crop and they'll plant it in late July, first part of August, and have it ready for for harvest a couple of weeks before Thanksgiving. So you've got fresh cauliflower for Thanksgiving. Carrots and beets. There's plenty of time to do carrots and beets as well. If you want to try and do a fall crop of peas, that can work sometimes too. I've never had great results with the fall pea crop,
but
I have a lot of customers that do though. They come in and say, "Oh, I had great peas last fall." It's like, "Oh, yeah, great." I don't have.
What are they doing? Are they putting a board over the row to keep the seeds from drying out?
They're getting them to germinate, okay. But the biggest problem that I have is either they're blooming when it's too late and they freeze, and so it freezes the blossoms, so I don't get good pea set, or it's I plant them too early and it's just too hot and they just kind of suffer through, the first part of August and when it's 100 degrees outside, like it is right now. And so timing has to be just like perfect and weather's got to be just right in the fall for it to work. And I just haven't had great results with it. But a lot of gardeners who come in the store, they just have awesome results. And so I say, more power to you.
way to go. Yeah,
I can't do it, but I'll plant my late corn and my carrots and beets and other stuff in July, and then we have like a really nice crop of stuff coming on in September when everybody else's gardens are pooping out. So
are there any particular varieties that you've
think work, like especially like spinach or lettuce, that work pretty well with a little bit of heat
Yeah, any of them will really do well because they're going to germinate really quickly right now. You know, surprisingly, you know, grass seed in the springtime takes 3 weeks to get it to germinate. Right now, it's taking 5 to 7 days. So your lettuce and spinach, which are probably in that, you know, lettuce definitely takes 2 weeks in the springtime, sometimes three to get it to come up. It's going to be up in a week right now. If you can keep that nice and moist and you know, don't bury it too deep, that seed will be up and going. And those little small seedlings can handle the heat. It's when they're really starting to produce, you know, leaves that you want to consume. When the temperatures will be cooling down in September, it'll be perfect.
So for me, I would imagine, because I've had this problem in the past, it's basically keeping them moist enough in the spring. Yeah. That's not usually a
problem.
That's
not a problem. But right now,
yeah. So, it's a little bit more difficult. What do you do to mitigate the heat so that that the little seedlings don't dry
out? You know
what?
I'll take a rake, and I'll rake the area where I'm going to plant. And I like to do kind of wider rows. So I'll rake an area about 6 inches wide, and as long as I feel I want to do 15 feet or 20 feet or whatever, I'll just kind of rake that area. I'll sprinkle my seeds out. And then sometimes instead of putting soil over the top of them, I'll put either just a little bit of peat moss or a little bit of potting soil. Just depends on what I have sitting around.
So like a little mulch
sitting around
on the
house.
Top.
Yeah, just over the top. And then I'll step on them really lightly. I won't stomp on them, but I'll just kind of take my feet and just walk down the row and just kind of press them down in, almost like running a roller over the new grass. So if you're planting new grass, it's kind of the same principle. So you're just kind of packing them down just a little bit. And then I'll take my watering can with a fine water breaker on the end, and then just water them really lightly once a day to get them to germinate. And that mulch holds the moisture, and it's hot and the soil's really warm. And so they really germinate very quickly that way. And I do the same thing with my carrots and beets and stuff. You know, the smaller seeds, it's a really good way to get those seeds to germinate without stressing about it too much.
I like how the peat moss works because it's not compactive. So when the seedlings germinate, they're able to get
right
up through
it. Yeah, exactly. And sometimes, depending on your soil, if you have a lot of clay, sometimes your soil has to crack, you know, to let the seedlings come up through. And so that little bit of peat moss is great. And we really should talk about green cover crops, and green manures, because, if people's gardens are starting to decline towards the end of August, first part of September, they've harvested everything that they want to get out of their garden, they can plant a green cover crop, clover or buckwheat or vetch or winter wheat or winter rye. There's a lot of different things you can plant out there. Let it grow for a couple months through the fall because it's not going to be affected by the cold weather or the frost or anything. It's just going to kind of keep growing. And then when you get ready to till your garden in October or early November, you can just till all that organic matter back in, and it's all green matter. And so you can add some leaves or some straw or, dried grass clippings or whatever else to it, and put a lot of organic matter back into your soil, because that's really what's going to build your soil up over time. Not necessarily going to add tons and tons of nutrient value, but the organic matter is going to loosen up that clay. It's going to lighten up your soil, and you're going to have a much, much better garden for the next year if you can do that. And
I like what the peas did to this section.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking maybe I'm going to do a winter pea of some kind.
A lot of people are nervous about tilling weeds and other stuff back in the garden. I'm going to tell you, no matter what you do, you're always going to have weeds.
Yeah.
So it's like, why not use the organic matter? I mean, because if you've got purslane growing as fast as I do, makes great organic matter for the soil. But it does drop a billion seeds. So, I mean, you're going to deal with it for years to come. But, any organic matter you can add to your soil, if you're sandy, it's going to help your soil retain moisture better. If you're heavy on the clay side, it's going to break that clay up, and it's going to improve that clay over time. And all of a sudden, you're going to have much better soil. So whatever you can add into your garden in the fall, organic matter-wise, is going to be just so beneficial for your garden. You won't believe it. And that's really a good time to put your fertilizer on as well, too. We'll throw a little balanced fertilizer, 16-16-16 out there. Or if you're feeling like you're low on nitrogen, do the ammonium sulfate. And there's a lot of really good forms of natural fertilizer out there as well, too, that you can use. Corn gluten's high in nitrogen. But definitely use soil activator humate. The humate is amazing how it will decompose all that organic matter and break that down through the wintertime and freeze up all the nutrient value of that material that you put in there and makes it available to your plants for the next year. So that's almost critical that you put that in if you're adding all this organic matter.
So if you wanted to grow something like a winter pea, is that something that you leave through the winter and then till it in the spring?
You could leave it through the winter and then till that in the spring.
Just don't let it go to flower?
Yeah, it's just whatever works for you. Vetch is very, very nutritious to put back in the soil, but if you let it go too long, it's out of control.
It's like it becomes a weed.
Oh, it's like a vine, and you try and till it up, and it just like binds up in your tiller. You have to be really careful with that. But buckwheat's great because the bees absolutely love it. If you have beehives or your neighbors have hives, and they're going to just go nuts in the buckwheat late in the fall. They're just going to absolutely love it. So clover as well, too. They love the clover. So
buckwheat does not overwinter. You just till it in.
Just till it in. Yep. And the clover is kind of the same way. You know, people get worried about the clover coming back. But, I mean, if you grow it for just a couple months and then till that in, you're not going to have tons of clover coming up the next year. I mean, you might have a couple little spots here and there, but it's going to
easily taken
it's
care
gonna
of.
Work that right back into the soil, and it's amazing how that builds your soil back up.
Well, we only have about 6-7 minutes left in the program. If you'd like to call with a question or comment, Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden is in studio. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also email us your question at upraccess@gmail.com. or tweet us your question at #AUGarden. So I'm looking at my garden, and it's looking pretty good. What am I going to expect, let's say, with corn? What's going to be coming up with corn? If I planted it a little bit later, I'm hoping maybe I've bypassed the corn earworm. I want to make sure I get the nitrogen on when it starts to tassel out again.
Sure. We've been eating corn for 3 weeks. Since,
it's been a good year for getting corn
in
early.
Yeah, corn's been great. Haven't had any problems with corn earworms yet, but it's usually in August. It's that August crop that usually is kind of bad. So if your corn's coming on and you've got silks forming, that's the time to treat your silks. And between like dipel dust, which is a biological insecticide, it's totally non-toxic to people, but very effective for worms, caterpillars.
Bacillotheringiensis?
Yeah, it's Bacillus thuringiensis. Bacillus thuringiensis. So that's very effective. Spinosad is probably my all-time favorite.
Because it's a little longer residual.
Longer residual works on contact instead of just by ingestion. So the BT or the dipel, they have to eat it before it will affect them, where the spinosad is also bacterial, also totally non-toxic to people and pets and even beneficial insects, but extremely toxic to caterpillars and works really well in the corn earworms. So that's a great way to treat your corn for corn earworms, is just to spray those silks.
I like it because any insect with chewing mouth parts, it will kill those insects. So I've used it on my bean beetles.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I don't get Colorado potato beetles for some reason,
which I'm grateful for.
But anything that is chewing, it will get.
Or it's the larva. It just takes care of all the larva. Yeah. So it usually won't kill those adults that are a little more resilient to it. But to any larva that are hatching out, which actually do almost all the damage, it's the babies that are eating all the plants. The adults are just out laying eggs. It's the babies that are really doing most of the damage, controls those very, very nicely.
We have another caller from Vernal. We have Margaret. Hi, Margaret. How are you?
Oh, good morning. I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Did you enjoy the opera?
I wanted to sort of change the subject just a wee bit from to Christmas cactus and ask, when do you have to put those in the dark to set the buds?
You probably want to start doing that fairly soon to really get those buds to set. They need to have, probably maximum of 8 hours of light a day. Don't hold me to it. I'm trying to remember exactly. And I might be getting it confused with the poinsettias because I haven't been thinking about those Christmas plants quite yet, Margaret. So, poinsettias for sure. You've got to get those into 8 hours of light and 16 hours of darkness. With the Christmas cactus, I don't think it's quite that serious yet. Probably not until probably October.
Is that just to get them to bloom
at
Christmas?
Otherwise, otherwise you'll have them blooming in January. So they just need to be limited to their light. And I don't like to move my Christmas cactus around too much. And so we usually have ours in the north window where it gets a lot of reflected light, but where it doesn't get a lot of direct sunlight, and it just seems to bloom and set buds on its own just fine if we don't have it in too warm of a location, and it doesn't like drafty locations either. So we've got it in a spot where it's a nice, good sealed window. It doesn't get too many fluctuating temperatures, and it really likes to be at a cooler temperature to set those buds. So if you can have it at about 60 degrees instead of 68 or 70, which is where most people like to keep their thermostats at, keep it in a cooler spot with lots of indirect light for right now. And then as the sunlight starts to wane, it will be setting buds like crazy for you in December, and it'll be blooming in January is what it usually does.
Uh-huh. One is sort of magenta color, and the other tends to be a more orangey color.
Yeah. Nice.
I wondered whether there was any necessity to treat them the same or differently.
A lot of the greenhouse growers will just kind of force them so that they'll be blooming at Christmas, because that makes a better gift than blooming in January. So that kind of works out that way. And it's more with the poinsettia is that you really got to limit their daylight hours starting in September. So I think you'll be okay if you want to do that, Margaret.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Margaret.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I'm just curious. So we've got about a minute and a half. What do you want people to be thinking right now as far as the rest of the summer? What questions are you having?
We kind of hit most of the key things. Definitely a good time to plant new crops in your garden. So perfect time right now. Best time of year to plant grass seed. If you want to fill in spots, if you want to overseed, rejuvenate an older lawn with some newer varieties of grass, or just plant a new area, this is the best time of year to plant. From now until about the 20th of September, it just doesn't get any better. And summer's been hot and dry and stressful. And if you really want your lawn to perk back up towards the end of this month, do a little fertilizer. Definitely do an application of humate, of the soil activator. It'll really help your grass recuperate after the hot, dry summer and get your lawn looking really good so that we can get it ready and prepared for winter so you'll be in good shape for next year. So those are important things.
Great. Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to Access Utah. Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden has been my guest. And in our gardening calendar, on August 18th at the Utah House, the USU Botanical Center, from 9 until noon, learn to preserve the harvest of your garden with a hands-on workshop. The class is designed for beginners who want to learn proper techniques for safe canning produce. Enjoy eating local produce year-round. To register, visit usubotanicalcenter.org. And on September 1st from 10 until 11, a class is taught at the Conservation Garden Park, where there will be you can find out how to use plants indoors and make your own terrarium. Seeding is limited, and the cost is $10. And to register, visit conservationgardenpark.org. And then on August 18th from 10 a.m. to noon at Red Butte Garden, join Golden Reeves and Bart Anderson in their sun-filled herb garden as they share tasty treats in the form of tomatoes from their own gardens. See and taste unique and rare varieties and learn a few helpful hints for successful tomato growing. Register at redbuttegarden.org. We're going to listen to Melinda's gardening moment, and thank you for joining us on this edition of Access Utah.
An old-fashioned favorite, hollyhock, is easy to grow, but the leaves are often riddled with orange spots and holes. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Rust is the cause of the orange spots on leaves. Though it looks bad, your plant will survive. A thorough cleanup in fall will help reduce the source of disease next season. The hollyhock weevil eats small, irregular holes in the leaves, while Japanese beetles can riddle the leaves with holes, eventually skeletonizing them. Knock these pests into a bucket of soapy water to reduce their population and feeding damage. Remove weevil-infested seed pods to reduce future infestations. Caterpillars and sawflies can also eat irregular-shaped holes in the leaves. Look for them at dusk on the underside of leaves and along the stems, and remove any you find. Healthy plants will survive these pests. Consider masking the damaged leaves with shorter nearby plants while allowing the flowers to shine through. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
You are listening to Utah Public Radio, a service of Utah State University's College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSUFM HD1 91.5 Logan. This is UPR, Utah Public Radio.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll dance the tango in its many forms, from the traditional bandoneon of Argentina to the pulsing electronica of the new tango of Finland and Norway. I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join me for Tango Around the World, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Friday night at 10 o'clock on Utah Public Radio.